Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Tina Packer is the founder of Shakespeare and Company, an acclaimed actor and one of the most influential and foremost experts on Shakespeare and theater arts in the country. Packer has synthesized 40 years of teaching, textual analysis, and stage experience into her new book, Women of Will, Following the Feminine in Shakespeare's Plays. The book is an exploration, an analysis of the women of Shakespeare's plays, and illuminates his changing understanding of the feminine and reveals some of his deepest insights as well. It's a great pleasure to welcome our good friend Tina Packer to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Those who know you know that you have been doing a show, a production, called Women of Will for the past several years. You brought it not only locally, but also to Off-Broadway for an extended period of time. So now we have a book entitled Women of Will. So which was the catalyst?
When I applied for Guggenheim 20 years ago, it was first and foremost to do a performance piece. In other words, I'd had this sudden insight about if you look at Shakespeare's progression of writing of women in his plays, and I suddenly saw that there was this pattern in them, and that you could actually see his spiritual growth through this. But I wanted to put it inside myself, if I can put it like that. So I wanted to perform it. So I began putting together a performance piece which allowed me to leap from play to play to play, at that point doing the whole canon. So, you know, encompassing all 36, 37 plays. And see what happened to me emotionally as I played an early woman, a middling woman, a late woman, and see what happened to me through doing that. But out of that came a whole load of other insights about what it meant to be a woman, which are mostly called interludes in this book, and that I began to perceive things that I hadn't perceived before as a director. And I'd been directing Shakespeare plays for quite a long time before I suddenly got this.
Right.
And so it began as a performance piece, but as soon as I realized it was going to be a written piece as well, I started making notes as we were going along, you know, kind of for the book. And that went on for years.
Because this is deep scholarship, really, this book of looking into Shakespeare and his relationship with his women characters.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, you could say, well, of course, it's deep scholarship. It's also deep passion on my part.
Sure.
Because he's the man I've spent my life with. And obviously, there's a kind of erotic element to it. You know, I love the language. I love saying his words. I love listening to his words. And I often think, is this what nuns feel like when they give themselves to Christ, you know? But there's something about the imagination that he awakens in me that gives me what it feels like a deep connection. So when I start thinking about something that I think he's saying in the plays, I then start studying. Unfortunately, there's been so much scholarship on him, you can usually find somebody who said something about it in scholarship. So I would then start looking at what the scholarship said around it. And of course, they come from it very differently. I say in the book somewhere, you know, they have the analysis of the printed word, whereas I live in the words. It's all splat and smell and touch and gluck and all that kind of thing. So I have a different experience of the words, but I have to say the scholarship that's around there really helped me.
But it doesn't seem like there's been a tremendous amount of scholarship on this idea of the women, of the female characters, and how it affects women.
Yeah, I don't think there ever has been. I don't think anybody before me said, look, the women are always the outsiders And if there's somebody out there that said it and I don't know about, I apologize. But the women are always the outsiders because there's only three of them in the play to 20 men or however many. You know, they're always looking at power. They're always having to, they're never the apex of power except for Cleopatra. They're always having to think how to maneuver and manipulate power. And what you see is that Shakespeare not only writes from the inside of women, after a certain time, not in the early plays, he projects on them, but after a while he writes as if he were a woman, and also he sees the bind they've been put into because they're women. So he writes about the social structures that is actually inhibiting them from being their full selves and what they have to do in order to maneuver, in order to be their full selves. And then you start seeing that over his lifetime, that the way in which he wrote about women actually is his spiritual journey. So it's when you get to the end of the plays, there's always, you know, it's the young girl who's brought up in nature who's going to redeem the sins of the father. Mm. But then there's always a magical person, a witch or a spirit, a creative spirit like Ariel, who is going to join with the young woman. There's always a few good men who are going to join with the women. But essentially, it's the women who says, this is the way out of the violence. This is the way. This is how we can look at the world and actually make it a better place. And it's the women who do that. And Shakespeare's, I think, very clearly pointing, that's what I think. And it has to come through women's voices.
That idea of it having to come from women's voices, but we also, and it seems that you pointed this out in the book, but we also learn of how the male characters react to the women in the situations that they are in.
Yes, yes. And you usually can tell whether he's a good bloke or a bad bloke by the way in which he reacts. Or if it's a Lear who thinks his daughters should do as he wants to do at the beginning, and the two eldest do what he wants to do and then do such atrocious things later on. So they're good girls. They obey daddy and they tell daddy how much they love him. And then as soon as they've got the power, they do excessively violent acts. Or the one like Cordelia, who actually tells daddy, you can't ask me this question. I'm not going to answer it. It's an unfair question. And he throws her out, as so many of the fathers do in Shakespeare, throws her out. She's the one, almost because of that, is the person who can find her center better and come back and see if she can't rescue her father or redeem him in some way. So you start seeing how he feels women who go on inner journeys and strengthen themselves and still stay in touch with their compassionate voices are the ones who can lead the way out.
Tina Packer is our guest. The name of the book is Women of Will, Following the Feminine in Shakespeare's Plays. When we look at the early comedies of Taming of the Shrew, as well as the Comedy of Errors and Two Gentlemen of Verona, I guess that's a good place as a starting point of how the women are seen in the plays.
Right. And what you see, I mean, Taming of the Shrew, which is the most popular and the one everybody knows, I never got it. It was after I'd done Taming of the Shrew a couple of times, so I'm not saying that it's always obvious. But what you see at the beginning of Taming of the Shrew is that Kate is very wayward and willful, and nobody wants to marry her, and her father can't wait to get rid of her, and everybody wants to marry the sweet little sister, Bianca. So she's a shrew that has got to be tamed. Who's going to tame her? Well, this man who's fought wars and knows how to tame people. Petruchio. And then, you know, they meet and they have a few rounds with each other. And most productions say, oh, look, we've got to do, they're madly attracted to each other. Well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But his subsequent behavior is horrendous. You know, he marches her off to church. He abuses everybody in the church. But then he takes her back to his house and he starves her. He takes away her clothes. And worst thing of all, he won't let her have her language. In other words, he won't let her say and think and feel what she wants to say and think and feel. And he forces her into submission. And then at the end, oh, it's all fine. You know, she says what she's meant to say. Well, this is actually a horrible story, if you think about it. But most people have loved this play for time immemorial, and most directors make the story a nice story. But the fact is, Kate is an abused wife. And yes, what she has to do in order to have a relationship with Petruchio is lie about who she is and start behaving the way in which he wants her to. And I don't think that makes a good marriage. And I do think Shakespeare at this point thought that was a good crowd pleaser. Mm. And he meant that it, you know, yes, it was all going to be great. She shut up. She's no longer a shrew. But I think later on, he started seeing the enormity of almost the evil of that, that women should be so abused in order to make them behave the way that men think they should behave.
That distinction of being what he was writing as a truth to him,
right,
versus what he was writing for the audience.
Yes.
Of what he wanted to be performed to bring people in.
Right. Well, at this early moment in his life, I think he was more interested in what would bring people in. And I think he was writing a play that he thought would be popular. And indeed, he was right. It's been popular ever since. But he also wrote a play in which the sexism is so deeply embedded that people even today don't even question it. I mean, that to me is the enormity of the sin, is that we can watch that play and don't even question that sexism. And he himself, he began with Kate saying, "My tongue will tell the anger of my heart, or else my heart, concealing it, will break." So he knew that actually she had things she wanted and needed to say. But still and all, she's my chattel, my goods, as Petruchio says, I'm going to make her be like my hawk and my hounds. I'm going to make her obey my voice. I'm going to make her feel the bit. I'm going to, make her obey. And he does. And then you can say, oh, well, she's happy now. She's obedient. But it sits very uneasily with me, Joe. Mm. I would not like to be married to a Petruchio, but I don't think it was until later, maybe writing the history plays of the Henry Sixes, which he was doing at the same time as those comedies, that he began to see what a bind women were in. I mean, if I just switch to Margaret of Anjou for a moment and the Duke of York, who are great opposites. And Margaret of Anjou is a feisty woman. She's running around when she's 17 on the battlefield looking for somebody to fall in love with her and marry her. And, she does it all on her own. And indeed gets married to the King of England, who's not a good fighter. And so she takes up arms herself and leads the armies. Now, when she gets hold of the Duke of York, who has successfully made it a rule of the land that her son will not inherit the crown of England, but his sons will, and that he will inherit from Henry, when she berates him in that early long speech, it's all about how he's a traitor to the country, he's a traitor to his word. He turns around and then berates her, and it's all about how dare you, you're a woman, you should be mild, gentle, soft, pitiable, you're a monster. It's all about her sex that he berates her. If she were a man, it would have been a different story. They would have said how valiant you were on the battlefield, how well you fought, all those things. But because she's a woman, she's dissed. And I think as Shakespeare started writing those scenes, he began to see this huge double standard that there was for women. It took him a bit of time to start writing about it. But when he actually perceived it, then he never stopped writing about it after that, that women are, they're expected to behave in this kind of a way, and actually what their true nature is to do this, and then they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
And when you say writing about it, it's this portrayal of definable independent thought.
Right. Yes. So what happens, and as you know, I have a long chapter in the book about these years, which are called the plague years, which is 1591-92, but it's also the years before that, where he's travelling on the road all the time. He's poor, he's writing his first plays, he's trying to make his mark. And then suddenly, with Romeo and Juliet, he changes his story almost completely. And, well, first of all, the play is called Romeo and Juliet. Suddenly, the women get equal billing. So it's not the Taming of the Shrew, it's this man and this woman. And you suddenly get this portrait of two human beings ecstatically in love with each other and what they're able to do together. I mean, the commitment that they can have to each other, how they can shift things together, how the power of that relationship can make a real difference in the world. And then, of course, through a series of mistakes and horrible incidents, they both end up dead. But even so, the love that they had for each other brings the parents together and they stop fighting in Verona after that. But you suddenly see Shakespeare in his imagination thinking, what would it be like if men and women really were equal? And he never loses that again. He's always putting up portraits of men and women being really equal and what can take off out of that relationship.
And as he is maturing as a playwright, he is also maturing as a human being.
And as an actor.
And as an actor.
Yes.
And is becoming more familiar with relationships.
Yes, much more.
Which you posit in the book of what that would be like.
Yes, I think so, because when he leaves Stratford, and he's got three kids by the time he leaves Stratford, and Anne, his wife, is 8 years older than he is, and they got married. She was pregnant by the time they got married. Not an unusual circumstance, I have to say, but they got married, and then how was he going to earn his living? How was he going to actually find his way in the world? And obviously, he was enormously talented. That couldn't have been lost on people, whether it was as an actor or as a writer writing orations over a dead calf, which supposedly he used to do. But it couldn't have been lost on people, and so he goes off to become a player. But almost simultaneously, he starts writing plays as well. Now, you have to remember, acting and playwriting are new professions at this time. So they're not old. They are old professions. But really, all the way through the Middle Ages, there hasn't been professional acting troupes. It was not, you said, oh, I want to be a lawyer when I grow up. You didn't say, oh, I wanted to be an actor when I grow up. Or you didn't say, I wanted to be a playwright. So here he is wanting to be an actor and a playwright. And I think that what happened to him after he left the family in Stratford, he was able to build the relationships that he wanted to build. He was able to find himself the patrons he needed to find. He was able to interact with other playwrights. He was able to interact with the intellects of the age. And because he was clever and bright, you know, the playwrights did interact with the aristocracy and the other brains of the age, if I can put it like that, including Elizabeth herself. You know, so there was, he was able to do all those things. And, you know, as I posit in the book, I think he fell in love passionately with the Dark Lady of the Sonnets, and that she was somebody that he'd never, kind of woman he'd never met before in his life.
Tina Packer is our guest on the book show this week. The name of the book is Women of Will, Following the Feminine in Shakespeare's Plays. It is published by Knopf. You also tackle what I think is really interesting, because, and you spoke of this early on in our conversation, about the spirituality that was going on as well, which is a very large role in this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, if people say they're spiritual people in this day and age, it usually means that they go to an ashram or they go to Kripalu or they go to... Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Sometimes it means they're going to be a priest or a nun, but that's very unusual. But there's it's not part... It's almost, we're so, I don't know, corporal. I don't know what the word is. Being spiritual is not... a part of our life, and yet I would say it's often what we yearn for more than anything. But for Shakespeare and for the Elizabethans, the whole world that they lived in. First of all, everybody knew the Bible, believed the Bible. That's what you lived in, the world of the Bible. It was only a few playwrights and a few people like Walter Raleigh who were questioning that truth and were saying, yes, maybe they were agnostics. And how did we know this was true? But the idea of the soul, that immortal part of yourself, the essence of who you were, was a huge issue, because what was the soul? Where did it go? Is it the soul that's going to whatever the after place was? Is there an after place? This was all part of their daily conversation. And it's in all the plays. You know, he talks about the soul all the time. Well, a lot of young actors today have to think, well, I don't know really what the soul is. What is it? I'm going to make up what it is. You know, it's not part of our education. But for Shakespeare, you know, his idea of the soul shifted. But if I had to say in the end what it was, I would say he would probably name it as the most creative part of himself that could imagine things that were not there before and create a reality out of them, which gave him a truth, an inner truth that allowed him to write those plays. I don't know if that makes sense to you, Joe.
It really does. And I'm also, two things come to my mind. First of all is, and you touch on this, of also what is going around, what is going on around him by other playwrights.
Yes.
And a reaction to that.
Right. Well, Marlowe, of course. I mean, Marlowe, you know, first of all, he would say he was an atheist. Now, to run around saying you're an atheist is not a very good idea because it's a beheading offense, you know.
Right.
But he also was being kind of rebellious and out there. But then there was this whole question of his religion. Now, this also is true of the whole country. So, you know, Henry VIII left the Church of Rome, but he did not leave Catholicism. So suddenly Rome and the Pope is not the boss of England anymore, which it is in more or less the rest of Europe, maybe some German states after Luther. So this is a break with Rome. But Henry VIII himself has always said he was a real Catholic, but his son Edward, who ruled for 6 years, was a Protestant, and as soon as his dad died, he took the whole country over to Protestantism. And then he died, and his sister Mary took it back to Catholicism and burnt anybody who wasn't a Catholic. So by the time Elizabeth gets there, she says, we're not going to look too deeply into men's souls. Everybody's got to go to church. Everybody's got to follow this common book of prayer. But we're not going to keep on killing people because of their religious beliefs. You believe what you like. We're going to try and hold ourselves together, which is a huge breakthrough. But that doesn't mean to say we're getting less spiritual. It's just the absolute truth of God in his heaven, the church being the law of God on earth, is now undone completely. And people are saying, I've got my own relationship with God. And the more the Protestants go over towards Puritanism, it's me and God, and I can think and feel what I like within that. We've got the beginning of America, really. But this is something which is being talked about in everybody's life. Whereas Marlowe just made hay. He became a Catholic spy, and then was a Protestant spy, and then a Catholic spy, and in the end he got himself killed in a pub in Deptford. You know, they said it was through a bar bill, but actually it was because he was spying on everybody and they wanted to be rid of him. And they were sick of, I suspect, they were sick of the things he was writing about, which was sodomy and, you know, all these things which were no-nos. It was really pushing the envelope. So he ended up dead. Shakespeare would never do that because he's got to support a wife and kids. You know, it was always practical. I've got the wife and kids to support, and did, and ended up making money. But as a consequence, found a way to say radical things without it deeply. He never went out to deeply offend people. He always said, why don't you look at it this way? Or could we just examine it that way? Rather than in your face stuff, as Marlowe did. Or Kidd, you know, Kidd, they ended up, they were so poor, so many of the playwrights. Shakespeare, of course, was an actor, and then he was a shareholder. So he was a much better businessman than they were. And they weren't actors, and they weren't and they didn't own shares in playhouses. So he knew what he needed to do in order to keep himself steady and stable, which again bespeaks well of his inner life, I think.
The book is amazing. It is Women of Will, Following the Feminine in Shakespeare's Plays. It is published by Knopf. Tina Packer, thank you so much for being with us. What a delight to have you.
Thank you, Joe.
A great pleasure. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.